let me remind you, the last time we met here, that is, we considered this matter of forgiveness, and we saw that as long as there was this separative self-consciousness which put an I here and a you there, and as long as this consciousness was dominated by the sense of otherness, then the situation for what is commonly called forgiveness would arise. Because the separate I alone can be wronged or hurt, etc. If there were no separate I, if there were the realization that what we commonly call oneself really is only part and parcel of one total reality, then there is no other who can wrong me or hurt me. And therefore there is nothing which we commonly call forgiveness which is necessitated from me. This is a very important point, this sense of otherness. You will discover that as with discipline, this realization of the wholeness becomes more and more vital and vivid in one's own consciousness, then life is very peaceful. In the midst of turmoil, there is a peculiar harmony, and it stays with one. And not only is it a harmony which stays with one, but it is an active force which induces an atmosphere of peace and friendliness and harmony around. It's very important to realize that friendliness must have peace associated with it. Otherwise, that friendliness always topples over. You know how the sort of positive type will be aggressively friendly. Oh, you must do this, you must do the other, come on, let me do this for you, and so forth and so forth. It just won't leave you in peace. You see? So there must be this strong peace, which is the sort of ground for the manifestation of friendly action. Now, after that, you remember, we looked into this book, Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, that portion of it which deals with what is called the Nirvanic Path. I think we will find it quite profitable to take the same thing again, but a few pages earlier. And then when we come back to what we touched upon last time, quite briefly we'll come back to it, we will see more into it. The Nirvanic Path. And it starts with what are called the preliminary yogic exercises. First of all, taking objects on which to concentrate attention. Now this, of course, is what in Buddhism we call the different kasinas, the meditation on the kasinas. A kasina simply means some sort of object which acts as a focal point for your attention. You have an earth kasina. You may just take a little clay model of something, or just a little plate. Just a little round plate, that's the best. Generally earth color. And of course in India, earth color meant for the greater part of the year a sort of a light brown color. And so a light brown earthenware plate was used, you see. Then you use the element water as a kasina. And you just put a bowl of water in front of you. Generally it was placed approximately the length of a tall man, say a fathom's distance away from you, you see, or as they sometimes called it, the distance of a yoke of a cart, you know, which was also just about 6 feet, 5 to 6 feet in length. Then, as far as regards the air, for an air casino, you just had to be aware of the wind and nothing else. And for a light casino, you made a hole in the window, let the light through and use that, you see, and so forth. Now, when one practices this sort of thing, all kinds of things do happen, you know. Some remarkable things happen. That is to say, you become acquainted with that element, that particular element on which you are concentrating, in its universal sense, in its universal existence throughout the world. And you realize that the same is inside you. So the sense of separation, this is something different from that. You see, it is different in so far as the actual appearance is concerned, but it is not different in quality. It is the same sort of thing. And therefore this sense of the relationship between this body and everything else that there is grows. When the sense of relationship grows, it acts as a power which dissolves the egoistic self-awareness. The intensely egoistic self-awareness begins to dissolve away, you see. That is one of its values. There are many other values too, particularly the one which all the monks, whatever the monastic order they belong to, sought so much, namely to be able to enter the deep states of consciousness. One must never translate the word jhana or dhyana, the Sanskrit dhyana, as a trance. Even Edward Kamsa has used the word trance, and he has spoken somewhat slightingly of the entry into the trances and coming out. He says all that happens is that you are entranced, that you just have to come out of it. It doesn't mean wisdom. I think he's entirely wrong there. If you take careful account of the fact that the Buddha laid the greatest emphasis, he was constantly telling his bhikkhus, do not miss your opportunities. Here are trees. Sit down and meditate. Don't give yourselves cause for remorse afterwards. And there is ample evidence throughout all the discourses, whether they are the long discourses or the short discourses. I think it may be as much as 90% of the discourses you will find the mention of these deep states of consciousness. Obviously, they are of fundamental importance. Obviously, you see. And so these kasinas help the person to enter into one or other of the preliminary deep states, the jhanas. Hence the usefulness of the kasinas as such. You see. The danger there is the sort of self-hypnosis business. You can get into a somnolent condition. Not be really wide awake, lose your wide awakeness in the same way that one loses it when one goes to sleep. You see? And you might delude yourself that, oh, I have entered into such and such a jhana, when you haven't. You have to be extremely wide awake, fully wide awake, without tension, without strain, I mean. See, that is important. But the different kasinas helped. And there were not merely the four elements, there were 10, 15 different kinds of kasinas which you could use. In Hindu yoga, there are innumerable.
What is the difference in a kasina? I mean, is a kasina a sort of... A mandala
has a design.
Yes.
A kasina is just a lump, more or less. You see, it's just like a bowl of water. There's no pattern in the water, apart from the shape of the bowl itself, which contains it. Mm. And air? Mm-hmm. What can you do with an air kasina? Modern times, if you're a football enthusiast, blow up a bladder and say, there's the air inside and I'm going to concentrate on it. Or have one of these transparent things which are nowadays available. You see? But a mandala has a very distinctive pattern. Mm. That's a very different thing altogether. that is the mandala which affects you definitely through your so-called unconscious and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's a different right. So that's the first part with which it deals. I have presented it in a rather simplified Theravadist manner. He presents it here in a slightly different manner. There's not so much difference between.
You mentioned the Buddha said, go into the forest and meditate. Don't be remorse.
Don't let give cause for remorse afterwards for missing your opportunity.
Now how precisely do you mean this word remorse? That if you don't...
Yes, well, you see, if you miss your opportunities, later on you say, oh, I wish I hadn't been so foolish as not to have done what I should have done 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and so forth, you see. That's what he means. You see? There is a tide in the affairs of men. All right. Now, let's come to this second point here, which is headed the tranquility of speech. The observing of silence after having cast out the dead breath, that is your expiration in short, is called the tranquility or immobility of speech, or the speech abiding in its natural state. Now note carefully, after having expired, you see, after the expiration, you know, if you watch your breathing process, you find you breathe in and then you breathe out, and there is ever such a slight pause before you take the next breath in. The rhythm goes like this, you start in and out, just a pause, in and out, and there's just a pause, and the in is always a little bit quicker than the out. You breathe out more slowly than you breathe in under normal conditions. That's the way the rhythm of the breathing goes. And when the out is complete, there is that little pause, you see. And the observing of silence after having cast out the dead breath, that is, the observing of silence at that moment of pause, is called the tranquility or immobility of speech, or the speech abiding in its natural state. But what is the meaning of speech here? The unwary person would... Yes? It's the silent talk, the silent chatter there. You see? That's what is implied. You know, the Buddha very clearly taught that that discursive thinking is an activity of speech. Said it absolutely outright, just like that. Discursive thought is an activity of speech. This comes in the Majjhima. I was delighted when I saw that, because I've always said that, and people would argue with me and say, oh no, you're quite wrong. I can think without words. Try. Or I think in pictures, I think in feelings. But the visual images are never thinking until you have named those visual images and interpreted them. If you don't interpret them, it is not thinking. Discursive thinking in the ordinary sense. It's a feeling consciousness which sort of feels out things, but it is not thought in the strict sense of the term thought. The strict ordinary sense, I should say, because there is another aspect to it also. Now, or the speech abiding in its natural state. Now notice that he says the speech abiding in its natural state. Now this term natural state is going to recur again and again. We'll go on. Think not of the past at this moment. when you are quiet, when the breath has gone out. With practice, there comes the point, there comes the stage when there's a long pause here. A very long pause, and it becomes longer and longer. It can last a few minutes sometimes. In the Upanishads, they claim that you can be silent, the breath stops for one muhurta. A muhurta is a period of 48 minutes. I'd like to see it demonstrated first. However, I do not reject it. It may well be the case that in the sort of great achievement, so to say, that may be a possibility. Who knows? I don't know, anyway. Think not of the past, think not of the future. Think not that thou art actually engaged in meditation. Now, why think not of the past? So many things are involved in this. The past is dead. Why is it that we keep thinking about the past? 5 minutes ago, or 5 days ago, or 5 years ago. Why do we keep thinking of the past? Because there is so much which has never been properly worked out. So the corpse of that past, the past is like a corpse which we drag into the present. We are far less than half alive as we are. We have not realized fully and perfectly that we are the full resultant of the past. But if there is a full and proper resultant, it is not cluttered up by the memories of the past. That is to say, those memories to which we cling and which we reintroduce into the present. This doesn't mean that at all that you forget a single thing of the past. It is there. And if somebody asks you, in 1921, what happened, you can say, yes, this, that and the other. You see? But you don't cling to it. The clinging and all the emotions and thoughts and so on associated with that memory of the past, all those mean that one has not fully worked out in the immediate now when that past was moving, you see, all that belonged to that past. We haven't worked it out. So as the Buddha said, there is a substrate left over for rebirth, as it is called, for another jati, that is to say, another conditioned state. This is very important. In the enunciation of the first noble truth, the truth about dukkha, what is the very first thing said? Jati is dukkha. And of course, jati is commonly translated as birth, rebirth. But get the deeper significance of the word jati. The conditioned state is dukkha. See? Now we must very clearly bear in mind that this does not mean that treading the path is a process by which you get free of all conditioning. There is no such thing as complete freedom from all conditioning. But there is freedom from bondage to conditioning. There is freedom from being overpowered by conditioning. And all those elements are the elements which we ourselves inject into the situation by clinging to the past, by desiring that it might have been different this way or that way, and then entering into a long fantasy about the whole thing, which is utterly useless and unproductive. A waste of your life energy. You know, we are awfully intemperate creatures. Like nature is prodigal, we humans are intemperate all along the line. We have no temperance whatsoever. We are squanderers. You see? And then, if we go to the opposite extreme and become super parsimonious, we are repressors, which is also wrong. If we become of the latter sort, then it is impossible for us to express dana, charity, giving, generosity. We can't help it. Isn't that so? So it's very important to realize that the release from the conditioned state is release in one's own consciousness, in one's own mind. This clingingness is a matter of desire, not of the body. But every particular condition, actual condition which we are in, our own bodily condition, as well as the immediate physical surrounding in which we are. See, you can't even think about that. That is what it is. And all manifestation, all existence necessitates, indispensably necessitates, the conditioned state. Otherwise there is no manifestation. See, these things we don't really understand. If we really understood this, inside oneself there is freedom. It's a freedom such that one's clinging, one's crying over spilt milk of the past, one's regretting, oh, those were wonderful years when Jimmy was alive, you see, and this and that. And this everlasting misery, like Queen Victoria and the Prince Consort business, you see. All that is out of the situation. This is important to recognize. All the great teachers were mind healers. The realm of religion, where its heart and its disciplinary aspect is concerned, is the psycho-spiritual, not the physical as such. You see? The physical comes in only in so far as the actual physical nature of your organism has its influence upon the psychical life. You can't get away from that. If you have excess thyroid or deficiency of thyroid or any other glands and so forth, the ductus glands, it absolutely determines your pattern, the pattern of your psychical life. You can't get away from it. It is constantly an influence. You see? So in that sense, the physical comes in. But not in the sense of the pure material condition. After all, spiritual liberation has come out of those who have not had all that we think is everybody's right to have. The right circumstance, the right conditions, the best of everything, equal opportunities for everybody, welfare states, nothing of the sort. It was the stimulus of the other which woke man up, in fact. All right, let's go on. What a lot comes out of any one thing here. It's astonishing. This is one of the hallmarks of Scripture. The word of Scripture, excepting where the actual formulation is a bit faulty, the word of Scripture is such that it is like a wellspring. It just bubbles up all the time. It's fresh and new and inspiring. Think not of the past. Now, similarly, think not of the future. Because that is another form of grasping. That which is still to come. The shape of what is to come, you desire, shall be the pleasant. It's quite impossible to get rid of that. Or there is fear. This is our present situation. Oh my goodness, what will happen in a month's time if things go on like this? You know, the good old English statement, don't worry, it may never happen. And more often than not, it just doesn't happen. And that's that. See? Think not that thou art actually engaged in meditation. This is extremely important. If one is free from thinking that one is actually engaged in meditation, If one is really free, then the grasping aspect is out. The wanting a result aspect is out. Because the process of your meditating is spontaneous. Perfectly spontaneous. And when our life expresses itself harmoniously in perfect spontaneity, that is the complete absence of self-consciousness. And if there is the complete absence of self-consciousness, this is rightly related to everything around. It's not a blot upon the scene. You take this whole earth. It is man who can be a blot upon the world. It is he who has the power deliberately to be a blot on the world. Your animal hasn't got that power. Your tree hasn't got that power. A stone hasn't got that power. A snow-clad peak or the sea or the wind or anything on the phone. They haven't got that power. It is man who has the power to be a blot upon the world. It's very important, isn't it? So think not that thou art actually engaged in meditation. It will also enable one to be free from all calculatingness. Oh, am I progressing? Am I not progressing? What is the net result of it all? And then you get the fit of depression. You see? Why? Because the ego has not been nicely inflated. Depression is a deflation of the ego, which causes this miserable state. The deflation of the ego plays a very important point. Part in depression, because one has wanted to achieve, one has wanted to enjoy, one has desired that things shall be comfortable and pleasant, and because that is not there, this ego feels deflated, crushed, therefore he is depressed. All that is up then. Regard not the void as being nothingness. Very important point. The void is not nothingness. Are you coming to the summer school this year?
Me?
Yes?
No.
No, I see.
Sorry.
Well then, I'll repeat something which I said at Cobham. The word shunya, void, is derived from the root svi, and the feeling involved in the word shunya is being related to something which is swollen. Svi means to swell, but to swell in the sense of being blown up. See, you can have something swelling, but it is solid through and through. I mean, it's substance through and through. But if, for example, you take a rubber balloon, which is in a floppy state, you see, and blow it up, you see, then this rubber surface is blown up. So you get a blown up outside, you see, but with a hollow inside. This is the point to bear in mind. The blown up outside with a hollow inside. Or if you like, the swollen outside with the hollow inside. Now this word shunya, the void, which is also related to the word which is used in the Upanishads. The Upanishads use both words, shunya as well as bindu, the drop. Literally it means the drop, you see, bindu. Have this significance. The empty space within has no sort of reality apart from that exterior, that blown up film which is the exterior. This is very important. We talk a lot about shunyata and all the bandy about these words. The emptiness is the important thing. You see, now, for example, you know from your experience with the summer school how often this wonderful emptiness comes up, you see, and they're all talking about the emptiness. But it is rather a big question mark as to how much they know what they are talking about. All too frequently it is empty talk. This shows us very clearly that as far as we are concerned, the deepest depth we can enter, the highest flight we can make, you see, always has the two together. And as far as our perfection is concerned, of vision, of understanding, of realization, it is the non-duality which we can realize. There is no such thing as the absolute oneness. You see, you can postulate it, but you can't realize it in any sort of consciousness. In any sort of consciousness as we know in the ordinary sense. For this you have to go very deeply into the Upanishads and very deeply into the Buddha's teachings. And you begin to sort of touch, I can only say touch rather than see, that transcendence, which is the utterly beyond, the unspeakable. So the Upanishads say that from which speech and mind return, not having found. Not having found. The ultimate reaches of mind, the most transcendental sort of conditions of mind, the highest perfection that mind can realize, does not find that. This is where theistic theology utters an extraordinary truth. God is the wholly other than this. And of course it always raises up the problem, what is the relationship of this to that? See? And so forth. But we won't sort of enter into that field at the moment. So, regard not the void as being nothingness. Shunya means the emptiness, the hollow inside, with that film which is the blown up exterior, manifestation. Manifestation and non-manifestation have to be there together. Always, as far as our minds are concerned. At this stage, do not attempt to analyze any of the impressions felt by the five senses. Did the Chaukun incidentally say anything about this? Because this is very important. No. At this stage, do not attempt to analyze any of the impressions felt by the five senses, saying, it is, it is not. That is to say, you get an impression whilst you are meditating, and let not any of the senses say, yes, that is so, or that is not so. See? But at least for a little while, observe unbroken meditation, keeping the body as calm as that of a sleeping babe, and the mind in its natural state. Again, this phrase, natural state. You see? Keeping the body as calm as that of a sleeping babe. Observe unbroken meditation. One of the important reasons for this keeping unbroken meditation, is just this. You know, when you actually meditate in this deep sense, in order that the truth may be delivered unto you. One can't grab at the truth. Whatever is, delivers up the truth to you if you are quiet. You see? All right. Then, the moment there is that state of some illumination, our dear old friend Mephistopheles the ego jumps up and says, "Ah, I've got it." Quiet, quiet. Yes, something has begun. Let it grow. Let it come to fruition. Our impatience, our passion to grab a benefit, it's so ingrained in us, this greed, you see, and we stop the thing from coming to fruition. It's like the little fellow, you know, who sees an apple on a tree, he doesn't wait to let it come to, let it ripen. He says, "Ah, there's an apple," and he goes and grabs it. Out comes the apple. Then he takes a bite and that's the end of that. That's what happens with us when we do meditation. And we get very conceited, "Oh, I had such wonderful inspiration today," you know. It immediately puts me in a position of importance with respect to the other fellow. It's again the ego blowing up. This has to be watched. Oh my God, it has to be watched. It's a terrible process, but it goes on like that. So, preserve the unbroken meditation. This is one of the purposes of this hour and a quarter, just watching the one thing. Apart from its being a test of endurance also, you see. You go on like that. Just let be and see what happens. Keep wide awake all the time. Keep wide awake. And it will grow and grow and grow. Affect the deeps of the mind. And then later on, when the situation arises, and that is the stimulus, it will come out in the richness of thought and expression and so on. So, regard not the... But at least for a little while, observe unbroken meditation, keeping the body as calm as that of a sleeping babe, and the mind in its natural state, that is, free of all thought processes. This is, of course, very difficult. Because, as you know from your experience this last week, for instance, thoughts will impinge, they'll rise up, they'll keep rising up. When does the situation prevail where, when one is wholly attentive, when attentiveness is absolutely at its full, that thoughts will not arise? When does that situation arise? When there is no substrate for rebirth left over from the past. As and when one has arrives at this state of being able to give one's total attention to the immediate now, the out of stepness of psychological time with chronological time goes out, and they are in step. Then psychological time, one's sense of psychological time is out of step with chronological time, because one's desires, one's whims, one's passions, one's appetites, one's repressions, all those things come to play. And so, when it is 4 o'clock, we want our supper instead of just being content with tea. That kind of thing happens. But when all these disturbing elements in the psyche are out, and the psyche no longer disturbs total attentiveness upon the immediate now, what happens? The timeless reality is fully realized in the immediate moment. There is no such thing as timelessness apart from its manifestation through the immediate moment. How could anybody have realized timelessness, excepting that he found that state of perfect poise, of perfect quiet, and complete wide awakeness, complete attentiveness to the immediate moment, without grasping it, without grasping anything in it, wanting to prolong the pleasure, or swiftly to get rid of the noise or the disturbance or the mosquito that had settled on his nose or whatever it was. Then, you see, you are in complete harmony. You know, all this, on the one hand, is extraordinarily difficult. On the other hand, when it at last happens on some occasion or other, it's suddenly simplified. The difficult thing has become the perfectly easy thing. Take a simple example in ordinary life. When we are children, we try to ride a bicycle, excepting for those rare cases where somebody just jumps on a bicycle and rides off straight away. That does happen sometimes. But normally we have a good many tosses, don't we? We fall off the bicycle. But when we have arrived at a stage where we suddenly got our sense of balance, oh, this is how it is, and you just ride away quite easily. The difficult thing has become quite easy. It's the same thing happens with meditation, with being wide awake and attentive and so forth. Now, all that out of tranquility of speech. Then he comes to tranquility of mind. It has been said, by entirely refraining from forming thoughts and mental visualizations, by maintaining the bodily calmness of a sleeping babe, and endeavoring meekly and zealously to follow the Guru's authorized teachings. Interesting little note, Guru's authorized teachings. There will undoubtedly arise the simultaneously born state. The simultaneously born state is the state of nirvana. Now I think there's a very significant implication here. You know how Mahayana particularly comes to the ultimate conclusion that nirvana and samsara are no different from each other. Nirvana is samsara. I remember once at a summer school, somebody sort of said this, and the Theravadin bhikkhus who were present, ooh, they squirmed under it, you see. And then they just sort of outright, they laughed outright and said, how absurd, how impossible, how can the good be the evil or the evil be the good? But nirvana is samsara. Who can ever know God unless he is perfectly well acquainted with the devil? It's quite impossible. Why do we put it in that form? Why don't we put it the other way? Who can ever know the devil who has not perfectly known God? Because we as we are start from this direction that way. It's a one directional, it's a one way street. Isn't that so? That is why the Buddha also presents everything in terms of dukkha. You start with where you are. I am the imperfect thing. And the whole process of growth is towards the perfect thing. It's not the other way about. This we know, but that wonderful thing we don't know. That is still to come. Look at a girl baby that has been just born. After all, it's any little lump like any other little female lump. It might turn out a very plain woman, it might turn out the world's beauty, who knows? We don't know that. That has still to come. We start by being what P.G. Wodehouse called a poached egg on toast. All right. There will undoubtedly arise the simultaneously born state. Nirvana arises simultaneously with samsara. The hollow inside and the blown up outside. But the blown up outside is not perfectly smooth and that sort of thing. It is a twisted thing. It is a thing of pain. It is a constricted thing. You see? And hence the limitation and the difficulty and all the rest of it. But there can be no limitation and difficulty in that which is hollow, which is empty. See, that's the whole idea about it all. Tilopa, the great teacher, had said, do not imagine, do not think, do not analyze, do not meditate, do not reflect, keep the mind in its natural state. Again, this natural state. Tilopa must have been a precursor of Molotov, who said no to everything. See? Do not imagine, do not think, do not analyze, do not meditate, do not reflect. Keep the mind in its natural state. The empty state, the state of shunya. Let the mind be the hollow inside. And from this hollow inside, you just observe the blown up outside. The master of doctrines, the lunar radiant youth, which is the way they describe the great teacher Gampopa, hath said, undistractedness is the path followed by all the Buddhas. Undistractedness. This is what is called mental tranquility, immobility of mind, or the mind abiding in its natural state, the immobility of the mind. You see, the ordinary man of the world thinks, oh, it's not for me, I'm a man of action. He doesn't appreciate this supine condition. But he doesn't know what he's talking about. The maintenance of the immobility of the mind means that the mind is in active, dynamic equilibrium. I wonder whether, well, perhaps you have all played with a top when you were little. No, it's not on the desk. Played with a top when you were little. And you know that when the top spins absolutely perfectly, it seems to be still. But it has a hum. And one of the effects which the Hindu yogis try to produce by the word Om, see, they take a deep breath and they sort of concentrate their attention there. I can't hum, of course. You know, if your eyes are not, if there is no tension in the face, you will feel the throb there. And you will get an extraordinary sensation. Of course, this is sensational. It's an experience. It's a physical experience. You'll get that experience of the activity which is perfect equilibrium. That is why they do it. I used to spend quite a bit of time, more than a quarter of a century ago, practicing this. And it's very interesting. Mind you, it's good for your health, actually, physically. It's good for your health.
Is it because there is a
pineal
gland?
Pineal has nothing to do with the pineal gland.
No.
Don't get misled by this pineal gland business. You see? Yeah. You feel the throb right up here. It's extraordinary, the effect. But you see, the thing is, you start with the ooh. The O is the A-U, which has coalesced. A and U. U. They coalesce and end up with the
When is the mouth shut, as it were?
After the breath has almost gone out, and you'll remain throbbing with the and there's hardly any breath there. You get it pianissimo, absolutely pianissimo. Would you like to do it? Try it, see what happens.
Yes, I would like also to add this, that yes. I think that where you place your mind, so far there your voice will resonate.
Yes, that is true.
That because many figures of Buddha, it is such a hollow here.
I know. They have a little Ushnisha. The Ushnisha.
I've often really thought about this because this is the last place of a baby's skull to clear.
Yes.
There is a space that I've often thought there is some significance.
Practice it. See, well, I mean, in your own room, in the quiet, just do it. But mind you, keep all this perfectly relaxed. Let the lower jaw particularly be quite relaxed, easy there, and feel easy here. You see, anxiety to achieve, I think in the one of the first places where you tense up is there, isn't it?
Your eyes.
Yes, anxiety to achieve. Let that be at ease.
Doesn't even necessary to do that. It is the thought of it which creates the same result.
Yes, yes. Look, in the Yoga Upanishads, you will find it clearly stated that the sounded japa, this is a form of japa, you see, the sounded japa is extremely effective, but the unsounded japa is 10,000 times more effective.
Because one is using the inner ear.
Well, it means that your attentiveness is so perfect, so complete. You don't need the extraneous aid of the physical sound.
But you are doing stands with the same motions. You are opening your mouth and closing it for the air, are you?
That's when you sound it, but when
I thought it meant they meant that you simply that you do it with your mouth closed, in thought.
thought also.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know.
By thought, yes.
In thought, when you do it in thought, you can have your mouth closed or open, it makes no difference.
No. But you were saying that that is considered to be more important than the more bent.
The silent one, yes.
The silent one. Mm. With your, yes, with your mouth closed.
But it is very useful to first do this. I mean, after all, one starts with the kindergarten, doesn't one? One can't get away from that.
Yes, yes.
Is it easier to do the sound than to be perfectly certain that your mind is in that place and that your inner ear is following that sound?
Yeah, it's easier to do the sound first.
Yes.
Start with doing the sound, because you see, the actual experience acts as a sort of an anchor for the quiet performance, so to say. All right, let's go on. I mean, that is not so very important. Yes, we'll leave that now, the four recollections, the ordinary practices as such, and now. He talks of the first of the ordinary practices, the yoga of one-pointedness. One-pointedness is the way, is the translation given for ekagrata. Ekagrata. Eka means one, grata means made one, you see. I prefer to translate ekagrata as unified, not as one-pointed. You see, one-pointedness has the element of exclusion in it. It's directed only to this. But the real attentiveness is not an exclusive thing. It is an inclusive thing. The real awakened state is the inclusive state, not the exclusive. A person is all there, or I should emphasize both words, all there, the whole there, not a portion of the there. See? This is the important thing. And what actually happens is that all the different sense consciousnesses cease to quarrel among themselves for supremacy. The furniture of our mind is made up of visual impressions, oral impressions, tactile impressions, and so on. You see? And there are different impressions of that type because when attention was directed to the particular kind of stimulus, the shape, the mental shape given by the mind is predominantly visual, if you see something, oral, if you hear something, you see, and so forth. Tactile, if you touch something, and so forth. Now, these different sense impressions are like little children. They all want to be top, you know, the most important one. And they push themselves forward. Generally speaking, with most human beings, because the sense of sight is the dominant sense that we use it predominantly compared with everything else, the sense, the visual impressions and the visual consciousness is the one that wants to dominate. You will notice then that if you're studying something abstract, I don't know whether you've ever practiced this. Notice how you're interpreting what you're studying. It's always in terms, essentially, of your sense of sight. But if your sense of sight is secondary and your sense of hearing is the predominant one, you will tend to interpret the abstract predominantly in terms of oral impressions. It's a curious thing. Or if you have a very highly developed extremely sensitive sense of touch. It will be, you'll get a feel all the time of the thing. You know, we never practice these things. We never practice self-observation sufficiently deeply. We just go through life, we barge through life. And all too often blame the external pressures of life on us for this barging. But that is our situation. That is our school of learning, the pressures of life. We can't get away from that. Well, let us learn as much as we can. It's very important to discover the process of the mind. How does this particular thing, this particular engine work? And we must know the works. We can't always ring up an RAC when the when the thing stops. We've got to repair it ourselves. And if we don't know the works, how can we repair it ourselves? So you see, all these different sense consciousnesses are all striving for domination. But there comes the time when there is peace, there is quiet. And in that state of quiet, the whole mind is unified. And it is in those conditions of the pacified sense consciousnesses, with the mind unified as a whole in a state of harmony, that you have this extraordinarily heightened and deepened consciousness. Those are the instances where you see things with a clarity. You say, oh, everything is absolutely clear to me. It is. And then you know, once again, when the sense consciousnesses start clamoring, that goes away. That is why you know that when a man gets an inspiration, he just wants to put it down straight away, capture it and keep it. Because everything is perfectly clear. There is no disturbance. No clouds shutting out the view. Hello? Yes. So, the yoga of one-pointedness, the yoga of the unified state. This is the important thing. Don't know where you'll find any explanation of these sense consciousnesses and their pacification. It may be somewhere in some of the writings. I have never come across them. This I discovered for myself. This happens. This is how it happens. And the deep insights come. The first of these two parts, namely, seeking experience of the state of quiescence, which is the aim of meditation, through practicing the yoga of one-pointedness, may be practiced either with or without an object upon which to concentrate. If an object be used, it may be a breathing or a non-breathing object. Nowadays we just say an animate or inanimate object. The use of non-breathing objects, holy objects. The two classes of non-breathing objects are prescribed. Ordinary objects like a small ball or a small bit of wood. Holy objects, symbolizations of the bodily form, the speech or word, and the mind or thought of the Buddha. Well, you know, Christians do the same. There may be the image of the Virgin Mary or some saint or Jesus Christ or something like that. And so on. No, that's not so very important. We can leave that out. There's one interesting little thing. Whatever experiences the mind hath from moment to moment, report to the Guru at regular intervals and continue meditating. Just like being at school, isn't it? If oppressed with drowsiness, he puts within brackets, steady the gaze, meditating in a place from which a vast expanse of country may be seen. Londoners, Buy your tickets out. If the mind be sluggish, also make use of this method to freshen it. Fresh air very frequently is what one needs. And discipline it with undistracted concentration. If the mind be restless or wandering, sit within the hermitage, lower the gaze, and make bodily and mental relaxation the chief aim for the time being. Well, all that is not so very important. Then, of course, we have the pages which we did last time. Now,
don't stop.
Time has flown past. Is that still working?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
You've only been going for an hour.
Yes, we stopped. Oh, hour and a half nearly.
Started very late.
All right, sir. Now, just to recapitulate what we did last time, he talks of concentrating without using objects. The instantaneous cutting off of a thought at the root, the very moment as in a flash it ariseth. Second, the leaving unshaped whatever concept or idea appeareth. And third, the art of letting the mind assume its natural condition of absolute quiescence. It's so important, the emphasis on letting it happen. Don't strive after it, just let it happen. See? Be on friendly terms with the whole process. This is important. Now, we did that last time. And I think we also did this, didn't we? And the great lord of yogis, Milarepa, had said, when the mind is left in the primordial, unmodified condition, knowledge dormeth. When this condition is maintained, knowledge in its completeness is attained. I'll read that part again because I deliberately left out the qualifying clause. When this condition is maintained, comparable in its calmness to the flow of a calm river, knowledge in its completeness is attained. Wholly abandon all directing and shaping of thoughts. This is directly contradictory to several other systems of discipline where you are told to strive against evil and try and diminish it. The Theravada emphasizes the striving aspect very much more. The Mahayana presents very much more letting the thing happen. You see, we must consider this a little bit. There is an implicit striving in letting the thing happen. The striving is this way. Our natural tendency is not to let it happen, but to go and do it. Get rid of the obstacles, the hindrances and whatnot and whatnot. Now, we have therefore to strive with our impulse to go and do it. Now, what is the great wisdom of not going and doing it? And what is the wisdom in just in striving with the impulse to go and do it? Who is the fellow who's going and who is the fellow who is going to do it? I. But I am the imperfect one. I will only inject my imperfection, my greed, my folly, my stupidity, my incapacity into what I'm doing. Make a mess of it, isn't it? Those who are parents certainly know what it is like when the little growing child, you see, comes into the kitchen and wants to do the cooking with mummy. And the dinner is somewhat delayed, to put it most mildly. You see, we are like that little child, isn't it? We're anxious to do it, but we don't realize that we haven't got the skill yet. On the other hand, the physical analogy fails here, that skill is developed only by making our mistakes. We have to start some time or other, and we simply cannot do it perfectly in any case. So we have to start and endure our mistakes and hope that the others around us also will endure our mistakes and gradually obtain the skill. But with the mind it is different. The analogy doesn't quite hold with the mind. See? Because the mind is your own inner concern, and there is no such thing as a crash or a breaking of material and so forth. There is a crash in one sense, that your mind can be so upset that it can produce ill results, admittedly. But it's easy enough to deal with that if you have any normal common sense. All right. So, where were we? Yes, knowledge dawneth, knowledge is attained. Wholly abandon all directing and shaping of thoughts. Ever maintain quiescence of mind, O yogi. The great Saraha hath summarized the essence of the teachings concerning this dual process. The same teacher is also known as the great Saraha. Hath summarized the essence of the teachings concerning this dual process, which is concomitant with meditation, in the following verses. When bound or unrelaxed, the mind trieth to wander in each of the 10 directions. When freed, it remaineth firm and motionless. I have come to understand that the mind is a stubborn thing like a mule. Oh, I'm sorry, he says camel. But in India we use both, either camel or mule, as the stubborn creature. The mind is like a mule or a camel. Now he deals with the third process, the art of attaining the natural state of the mind, as if he hasn't said enough about the natural state already, but still. The third process, the art of letting the mind assume its natural condition, consisteth of four parts. The first concerneth maintaining evenness of mind. The second, keeping the mind sundered from thoughts. I'll just read the four in succession. The third, keeping the mind like that of a little child, looking with intensest mental alertness at a temple. The fourth, keeping the mind in the state which hath been likened to that of an elephant when pricked with thorns. But you can't prick an elephant with thorns. It's highly stupid. Those are the four states. Perhaps we'll consider them some other time. There's mm-hmm. such a lot which comes out of all this, you see.
What is this?
This is Tibetan Yoga and Secret Doctrines, Evans Wentz, one of the four volumes which he produced. Yes.
There are four volumes.
So there are four such volumes, you see. Not all entitled the same. One is the Book of the Dead, you see. The other is the Life of Milarepa. The other is the Book of the Great Liberation.
The government takes the back seat for society.
You have now. Mm-hmm. You have discovered something.
Liberated in the sense that
we've
used the word in Buddhism.
Yes. Well, Kant, if the intellect will predetermine that God is there, there is no liberation possible. You will always put God there. Away.
Well, how did Eckhart come to be?
All those great ones, Eckhart, Tauler, Ruysbroeck, Dionysius the Areopagite, several of them, quite 8 or 10 of them at least, they weren't bound by the dogmas of the church. They knew through their inner realization this is all nonsense. But they had to be very careful how they wrote. Ruysbroeck, I don't know why I can't pronounce his name properly. Ruysbroeck, isn't it? Ruysbroeck. Ruysbroeck wrote with a freedom which is absolutely amazing. And how on earth it ever slipped through the authoritarian. Oh, yes. All of them were Catholics. There have been very few non-Catholic Christian mystics of a very high order. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm aware, they have all been Catholic. Yeah. A Greek Catholic, Eastern Church, Dionysius the Areopagite, or the Roman Church. George Fox and such people were mystics, but I mean, no, there wasn't that realization. When you read their life, see what they, how they lived, how they spoke, and how they presented their teaching, and you will see all these. Of course, one can't see the drawbacks unless oneself has gone beyond them. Oneself has to have the power of seeing. You see, the 11 plus laddie cannot set an examination paper to the university professor. It's the other way about always. That has to be borne in mind. But you remember last time, I think, I said, see if there is any one thing in connection with the moralities which we can really look into during the fortnight and be completely free of it. Well, did we? During the fortnight? Be completely free of it. Or did we find ourselves stuck fast in the same spot? This is where the intensity of the attentiveness comes in. We do get opportunities, even in our busy modern life. We do get opportunities. And it's not a question of time. It can happen like that. If the intensity is there, or you can just go on for hours at a stretch and get nowhere. But if the intensity of the observation is there, the whole being is centered upon it, and you see that this is unnecessary. You see? And that unnecessary may be an item of wrong conduct, bodily or in speech or in thought, you see? Then it drops away from you. It drops away from you. You don't conquer it. It drops away from you altogether. Like a bit of diseased skin which falls off, you see. It just drops away from you like that. And then you find, not that you've moved forward, this is another illusion which we all suffer from, but you're standing on the same spot but not stuck fast there. You are standing free on that same spot. What's this idea about moving forward and making progress? Didn't the psalmist say so beautifully, if I make my bed in Sheol, thou art there. I may look or go or be, thou art there. Well, then stay here. Much more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Have dinner together right in your own home with the transcendent.
Habit pattern of attacking oneself, saying this is, you know, you see what you're doing, but instead of just seeing it and looking at it, you tend to say, this is wrong, and you start attacking yourself.
When one sees the thing for what it is, don't pass judgment upon it. See it with the clarity of vision and understanding which the judge in the court has with respect to both sides of the case. But you pass no judgment. You see the truth. And in that seeing of the truth in perfect calm and quiet, you see, you have disentangled the self from all the confusion and folly and wickedness and whatever it may be. And that is the liberation.
I know, but if one doesn't do this, one attacks oneself very often.
Live without hurting the self. Don't attack the self. See, hurting the self is a very pleasurable thing. It's an inverted form of pleasure. It's a perverted pleasure, isn't it? We talk of sex perversions and all the rest of it. But we have perversions in every field of our life. The thing inverts and it's a perversion. And we indulge in it. We have great pleasure in it. When we really see it as such, see it quite clearly, just keep on seeing it quietly until the point comes when you know in your own mind, ah, this is falling away now. This is another way of realizing the aloneness. Isn't there that marvelous thing in the Christian Mass? Keep your hearts and minds in the love of love and knowledge of God.
Yes.
You see? If we care for the transcendent, let that care emerge. You can't love to order. Not even the transcendent. You can't love to order. But be aware. Just be aware. The love of the transcendent, the love of truth, the love of reality, it will emerge. It is there. Well, see what happens during the coming fortnight. Now look, next fortnight we'll meet here in the usual way, and the fortnight after, and the fortnight after, as far as the Sunday and Saturday meetings are concerned. It's only with the Friday meetings that there'll be a difference. Friday meeting next fortnight will take place, but the Friday after that, which is Friday the 15th of August, there'll be no meeting on the Friday. I can't come back in time from our little summer school, you see, and do the needful.